It's all impugnators are really high tech. Got into that. And it's kind of like this whole point of worldview and how science has developed the way it has. You know, it's a whole topic. Let me start here. Yeah. One professor at the Harvard University. What's his name now? We'll come back. Anyway, he's the Santana professor of philosophy there. He was Bertrand Russell, Nobel laureate's guru and stuff. Alfred North Whitehead, very powerful person. And he said the safest way to characterize all Western philosophy is to say the whole thing is a footnote to Socrates. And Prabhupada, too, in his book, Dialectical Spiritualism, Prabhupada had disciples presenting different philosophers from the West. And he was critical of everybody. He liked Socrates. He said Socrates was the last honest man in Western philosophy, and they killed him. Right? Yeah. He said he was a good boy, just didn't have a guru. Yeah. So, very nice reading material is the Phaedo, Phaedo. Yeah. And it's the very, very last dialogue in Socrates. The poison's right there and everything else and so on. Yeah. So, it's okay. Yeah. Yes. So they're discussing everything, you know, and Gabriel was falling in the Phaedo. So, you know, the thing is, Socrates is going around exposing all the vanity and all the superficiality and culture and all this kind of stuff, and you know, we're all going to die and everything else, and not dealing with these kind of things. And the problem is, like the hippies, all the children of all these rich, influential people with their ideas and stuff are becoming his followers and renouncing their parents and stuff. So they said, we got to get this guy out of town. You know? So he had this charge that he was corrupting the youth and making them give up demigod worship. You know? So the trial was also a very famous thing. It's obvious in the trial that he had no desire whatsoever to try and like you know satisfy anybody. He was just setting his own ideas like that. So they found him guilty. The thing is, he had to either drink poison and die, or else promise to leave the city and never come back. So they had no, you know, thought whatsoever he would probably take the poison. They thought, okay, and in fear of death, he'll leave and won't bother us anymore, and so on. But he said, no, if I'm guilty, I should kill myself. I mean, they'll just go away. No. So anyway, the very last day, it's time to take the poison, and his disciples are there, and they're starting to cry. And he said, look, I already sent the women away. So we could die in peace without them all lamenting. And you start crying. You know, so, you know. And any questions, whatever. And they said, well, you know, we can just take you away and we'll go someplace else and so on. He said, no, why should I sacrifice my principles, right, for this temporary body? And he said, actually, a real philosopher is ready to die at any moment. But you can't commit suicide, so you got to wait. So here's an opportunity. And then they said, have any questions? And they say, well, how can you be sure that the soul is immortal? That when we die, it just isn't finished like that. You know? And he says, because you have very, very fine things come out of the body, like music, art, architecture, philosophy, honor, dignity. And these are not coming out of gross matter. Therefore, we must understand there's something in the body which is producing these things. Okay, can I go now? He said, well, wait a second then. What about a lyre, a guitar, right? It's made from wood, glue, cat guts. They used to take cat intestines. And something very fine comes out of it. And Socrates said, very good argument. You know? And basically it's the same argument as modern science. By combining carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and making DNA and RNA, you can make the Encyclopedia Britannica and the works of Mozart. And all these kind of things. The same argument that matter combined properly will produce life. You know? And so Socrates says, very good argument. He said, but you're forgetting one thing. What's that? The violin maker. Yeah, somebody living put them together. And beyond that, even the person who plays it, ain't right. So they go through so many arguments. You see Prabhupada using exactly the same arguments like that. He goes on and on. And then he says, have you seen perfect beauty in this world? I said, well, not exactly. Have you seen perfect truth? Not exactly. But you know what I'm talking about. Yes. Therefore, you must have lived someplace before where you experienced these things. He says there's a very ancient doctrine which says that all living souls come from dead souls, and all dead souls come from living souls. So in Socrates, you can see very definitely this, you know, coming from Asia and that kind of stuff, the philosophy. Then he actually goes right into the modes of material nature, how if you die in a certain kind of consciousness, you'll come back in a certain kind of consciousness. He says every act of excessive sense of indulgence or rejection is another nail which nails the purest soul to the tree of the body. One extra large moment in that. Until it is completely attached, and how can such a soul leave this world for free and unfettered to go and live forever with the gods? Okay. So he gives very, very incredible things for devotees. It's very, very nice, his ideas. And of course, he's an authority in Western culture, so Socrates, he was out, Socrates said that. So finally, he goes through all these different arguments, exhausting all these things about the immortality and character of the soul. Then he says, okay, any questions now? And the disciples are looking at each other, and finally they say, in your presence, Socrates, there cannot be any logical, you know, argument about the existence of the soul. But even still, we're afraid. Just like little children, they're staying in this strange house, and their mother shows them there's no monsters under the bed, there's no monsters in the closet. And when she closes the door and goes out, they hear these noises. So like that, we have these unreasonable fears. And Socrates says, yes, you cannot actually arrive at complete conviction just by jnana, by your logical discussions. You have to apply the words of the self-realized soul, soothsayer, every day. And there's a lot of them in Greece and outside like that. So to this point, hearing from somebody who's realized it every day, Krishna Katha, talks about God, you can actually realize it yourself. You know, so he took the poison. And he said that jail keeper famous life said, What do we do with you when you're dead, Socrates? And he said, first you have to catch me. So on. So you ready? Very nice. And who was Socrates' disciple?
Plato.
Who was Plato's disciple?
Aristotle.
And he was a genius, incredible analytical ability. Each one became a little bit less, you know, religious. So Aristotle was analyzing all the animals, everything else, geometry, all this stuff. And his treatises and works were lost to Europe for a long time. But then they finally, through Arabic translations, they came in with St. Thomas Aquinas. This was the beginning of the Age of Reason and everything else. And St. Thomas Aquinas said, yeah, this is the way to explain religion. You've got to go through and put it in logical terms and analyze everything and explain it in terms of analytical philosophy. Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, the idea is you want to understand a rabbit. First you cut off his ears, and you pop out his eyes, and you pull out his teeth. It's a breaking down in little parts, analysis. Let me understand reality. He took his PhD from the University of Paris, the same time as Saint Bonaventura. Bonaventura's idea was you make friends with the rabbit, scratch him on his skin, feed him, and synthetic. You start to work with him, and that's how you should know things. But the Pope decided that of the two, Saint Thomas Aquinas was the guy. And then Western civilization took this whole switch at this point, you know, from synthetic view of reality, integrating with reality, understanding reality, and going the other direction of analyzing everything and breaking it down and making it a machine with parts and that kind of stuff. So it's developed then, and we have, you know, modern science, you know, modern view of the world, and we try to analyze everything and look at it from that perspective. But even still, tomorrow night we'll start talking about Carl Jung. Right? He was about, Papa said, he's the last person in the book, Dialectical Spiritualism. And he finished, and Papa was saying, yes, he is right. That is right. Well, that is not correct. And Shama Sundar will explain a little more, and he will say, well, from that perspective, it is true. So many things he appreciated India. He was maybe 30 years old when Papa was born. And a whole history of development in terms of Western culture and philosophy. And Prabhupada said of all of them, he has the most sense. Very nice, intense person. Yeah. So even amongst these Nobel laureates, these big physicists, Albert Einstein, de Broglie, James Jeans, who else we got? Heisenberg, Schrodinger, all the guys who actually established modern science, there's many philosophical writings by them. Quantum Questions is also a very interesting book by Ken Wilber. And it's just an extract of different philosophical writings by these people. Einstein, he said, science can tell us how things are, but it can't tell us how they should be. You know? Yeah, very nice point. You know? We have an airplane. Maybe you know this airplane. The Enola Gay. Ever heard of this airplane? Enola Gay. It was the one that delivered the first atomic bomb to Hiroshima. Yeah. So they're going, you know, over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of open water with science is guiding them how to find the place. And they get maybe within, like, you know, 75 miles of the place. Okay, begin arming sequence, pilot to bombardier, you know, starting the arming sequence, okay. Depressing levers 3 and 4, depressing levers 3 and 4. Okay, opening bomb bay doors locked, depressing so-and-so lever. Okay, the instrument is armed, yeah, okay. At a certain point, they get from the thing that the bombardier actually takes charge. You know, okay, bombardier, you are flying the plane, and coming in, 10, 9, 8, 3, 2, 1. Yeah. I'm not going to do it. What's wrong? Nothing's wrong. It's wrong. It's immoral. What do you mean it's immoral? Bhagavad Gita says, the Bible says. We're going in a loop here. Yeah, because it can do it. The guy who pushed that button killed over 140,000 people, burned to ashes and death and everything else and so on. I don't know what the guy's life was like after that. You know, pictures and everything else. One person in the end just did this and just, you know, annihilated 140,000 people within, you know, those aftermath and so on. So this is Einstein's point. That, you know, science can tell us how things are, but it can't tell us how they should be. You know, what is ethics? What is morality? Even what is political science? They had this big discussion. We can just drop the thing in the ocean and tell them, hey, look, this is what we're going to start dropping on you. And the military said, no, they'll just, you give them time, they'll adjust psychologically, and they'll just fight to the death, even though you bomb them, you know. And millions of Japanese and millions of American soldiers will have to die. You have to hit them hard and just move in. So, okay, that was based on political science, and it may have been correct, you know, because for the first bomb, they didn't know what happened. They sent an investigation team out to look and see. It was so big, they couldn't even figure out what had happened. They were looking for something which would destroy 2 or 3 blocks at one time or something, you know. So they bombed them again, then they figured out, oh, this is, you know, something which annihilates entire cities. The first bombs were like, what is it, 40 kilotons of TNT. Now you got megatons and everything else and so on. So anyway, this is science. And this is what everybody now has this interest, right? It's the motivation, you know. There's a very, very good movie by the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation. Yeah, like that. You can pronounce it here better than I can. My mate, the British. The British Broadcasting. It was by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. It's the biggest organization in America. Every year they have a convention. So one year it was in San Francisco, and they had a notice of the best movies. They selected maybe 20 movies as the best science movies this year. It's for free. Okay, so Hare Krishna right there. You know. And one of them was science, .. fiction, science, fiction, by the BBC. And it was a very, very good movie on this, all the points in epistemology and science and direct perception. Is it actually valid? And the different rational processes and the social things about review, peer-reviewed journals and all this kind of stuff. And so many things on perception. Great, good movie. And the narrator was a young British philosopher, maybe like 35 years old. And they filmed it in a very old Gothic chapel in England, like that, very old and traditional. And right across the fence were 4 radio telescope dishes, and the dishes for radio telescopes. So made this very strong and visual contrast of the ancient traditional Gothic church and then the modern things. You know. He was talking and narrating. It was a very good movie. And the AAAS accepted it, you know, as being qualified. So the whole thing finishes off, and there's a rocket, maybe like, you know, maybe as big as this room in diameter, maybe like four stories, and it's going off in slow motion, and all the fires coming out, and the gantry is falling away, and it's going up like that. And this sarcastic British philosopher comes along, and he says, "Science is not powerful because it is true. Science is true because it is powerful." It's pragmatic. Because you've given us the stuff we want, we accept science as being a reality. But looking at it, no, it's full of problems, full of so many problems in different ways. It has some advantages, but Einstein, everybody else, says designed to work in a certain area. When you try to explain God and love and these things by science, you know, he said it's not science, it's scientism. Yeah. So very, very interesting development of how we got to this point. And ISKCON, because there's a philosophy behind science, which is materialism, right? Who presents atomism in Vedic culture? Sanadarshan. Which one of the six philosophers?
Kanada.
What's his book? Paramanivada. Yeah. And as I said, everything is made up of little particles and this and that. Then it goes to Greece with Democritus. Then it comes to the West. You know, everybody's adopted this as one idea. Another one is wave functions. Right? Matter can be described. Oh, I guess we're getting into string theory or something. But atomism was one basic idea. Yeah. But the fundamental philosophy behind it is very demoniac, very horrible. And people are being, you know, Kanada, Jainini, Astavarga, these are guys who eat entire civilizations. Their ideas destroy entire worlds. Chaitanya Charitamrita says, the ocean of ignorance, you know, ignorance, trying to cross over the ocean of ignorance is difficult enough to get through all the illusions and all the confusions to get through this. But to add to the problem, there are great ocean-going crocodiles, you know, like Jamili and Astavarga and Democritus in Kanada. Canada's still. We had our main temple in San Francisco, Berkeley. Big temple, six city lots. But in San Francisco itself, we have a little temple, about this size, small place. And it's in kind of a little bit of a tough inner city area, where the kids start drinking wine coolers, carbonated wine, you know, and 12 years old or something, different things, you know. So one girl started coming by, and she was very attractive with the deity worship and everything else, but she was always kind of sarcastic about it because she was frightened by the fact that she was attracted by this and what's going to happen and stuff, you know. But she made friends with the girls, and she'd come often, help make flower garlands in the deity club, you know. So she was about like 17 years old, maybe 16. And she told him she already had three abortions at like 17 years old. You know. Said, "I don't care," but you could see she cared a lot. You know. Her life was basically destroyed at that and so on. So she's an ordinary person, you know. Okay, you're pregnant. Okay, here's $100. Take care of your little problem. You know, it's ghastly, horrible, a situation like that. And this was prevalent. You know, life is just a chemical interactions, and so make some convenience for the chemicals. You know. But you don't feel that at heart. Some horrible things happen. So Prabhupada was very, 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 very enthusiastic. Actually, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, when I asked him about working with the Bhaktivedanta Institute, he got me on his, you know, laser channel and gave me Tamal Krishna Maharaj. He said, "Prabhupada said over and over again for his entire last year that scientific preaching is my number one preaching program." You idiot. He came from an aristocratic Austrian family. Amongst the Germans, the Austrians are most like, you know, rigid and uptight and everything else. His aunt was the first lady to to be a member of the Austrian Parliament. I can understand these guys are warriors and everything else. So she must have been a tough woman. You know? She was here all the GBC. Oh, why did you say that? You've already really suffered. Okay. So he came from a very heavy family. But he had problems with disciples. They're very qualified. So anyway, he told me that and everything else and so on. So Prabhupada did. It was very, very seriously talking about preaching in the scientific area because that's what people are accepting. You know? And he was very emotional about it. One time, my friend Bharata was in Hawaii, and Prabhupada was walking along the beach, you know, and he was talking about the rascal scientists. He said, they're good scientists, too. You know, yeah, but they're rascal scientists and causing all these things, like young girls to get, you know, 3 abortions, you know, all this stuff, destroying people's lives. You know. So he was talking along and just, you know, berating the rascal scientists. And he stopped talking, he was walking, and most of the devotees fell a little bit back, but Bharata was right to him. And to himself, Prabhupada said, God damn bitches of science. He didn't know the phrase properly. God damn bitches of science. They're very intense problem. But it's, you know, not the people, this, that philosophy and the idea they've developed. And ultimately, everybody is nice. It's a matter of, you're doing something wrong here. You know, you have to correct it. In our culture, violence is never good. But sometimes it's necessary to defend the weak against the strong when good arguments fail. Right now, I can tell you, right now in Melbourne, you have people with masks on, with knives, you know, cutting people and taking all their money. Surgeons. So see, the guy knows what he's doing. Cut me. Yeah, yeah. So Kshatriya has to know how to apply violence technically. So on. And again, it's only when good arguments fail. It's not. I did a lecture one time in Peru. One of our devotees, his father was head of the Secret Service, you know, for Peru, guard the president, all this stuff. So he went there, and it was a very, very high class area with, like, you know, it's just the houses had maybe 3 lots and stuff. We came to one place, there was all a wall in front of it, and there were 2 guys outside in full suits with machine guns standing outside the door. We kind of looked at him and said, nodded, you know, go inside. So we came inside, and the 4 of us. And his father was there with the secretary, signing some papers, embraced his son, okay, and saluted me, you know. So he said, go on in, I'll be right there. So we came in, there were like 40 police officers, all with like thick necks, short haircuts, sitting like this at their desk, you know. And there were maybe 15 police ladies, all their hair in buns like this, you know. Was sitting the same way with all the identical purses all sitting there. So I came in and kind of sat down. Then after a couple of minutes, he walked in, everybody stood up, gentlemen, ladies, and sat down. This guy is going to tell you about the character of an ideal police officer. Listen, okay. So I got up there, you know. And I explained, you know, Kshatriya, Brahmanas, and what your position is in society and so on. And they were listening. They bought books, too. You know. Then afterwards, one of them asked, he said, if you kill somebody in the line of duty, do you get bad karma for it? You know? Like, it said the same thing. It's not you know, good. And so I said, no, you won't get bad karma if you had to do it to protect people, but you won't feel good about it. I looked in the audience, about 4 people were kind of like nodding, like, they've done it, been there and stuff, you know. So this is our culture, our philosophy. We're trying to, like, you know, communicate these ideas to people and change people. And of course, our approach is by intellectually presenting these things and stuff. And just a few ideas here and there, they keep going out. They keep going out. There's a big result. You know, you think nothing has happened, but there's a big result in the world. When you start looking at things historically. Who is it, Dawkins? Yeah, Oxford, the biggest leaders in the world intellectually, their ideas go everywhere. And so Professor Dawkins, he's a lead biologist and genius. Yeah? So he wrote a book called The God Delusion. Okay. So what's it, Alan, I think that's the person's name. He's the head theologian, which theoretically is still formally is still the head of the university, the head of the Department of Theology. So he wrote a book called The Dawkins Delusion. And criticizing, you know, British are very, you know, there's 6 levels of meaning like that. Very, very subtle. And I'm sarcastic. Rodica said when Dawkins and the other guy would pass in the canvas, he would say, "Where's Dawkins?" Yeah. So anyway, he was dealing with them. And you can see many of the arguments he was using are our arguments. They didn't have them before. Probably said, we're not concerned about details, we're concerned about the principles and the ideas, like Socrates is singing about the guitar, you know, and so on. So many of the analogies and everything else, they didn't have them a few years before, but because devotees have been going there and everything else, they're starting to see these things and get good armor. First thing he did, he said, did not go to the level of talking about God. All of a sudden, in this environment, you talk about matter. We love matter. Ayurveda, Vastuveda, everything else. But, you know, it's not sufficient to explain everything. There's free will, there's beauty, there's immortality. Okay, some people accept, yes, okay. So what's next? Next is Atma. There's some principle which has these qualifications. Free will, control, everything else like that. About 30% of the time the glass of water gets knocked over. That's what happens tonight. These words in the glory. So Atma. There's some super mundane principle is there. The next thing you've got to explain is there's Paramatma and Jivatma. That two categories. And Jung, by direct perception, was experiencing these things. And so on. Okay. The next level, Bhagavan, you probably say, don't talk about that. Because that's too, that's personal. In Lima, we did a very, very good program there, and the professor was invited by devotees or friends to come and see it. He said, oh, when are you leaving? You have to give a lecture to my class on my art class, and can you come? Yeah, okay. So we went to the next week, and we went to his office with devotees, and he was very nervous. And he said, the head of my department wants to talk to you before you give the lecture. And, you know, it was obviously, why are you inviting a monk to come and talk? And so I went in there, and the guy's looking at me, and I explained everything. He said, well, okay. So I went in, and maybe like about 400 people there. The professor was in the front. And then the head of the department came in and sat up there in the back, and he's looking up, oh my God, I hope Swamiji doesn't destroy my career right here. But then some woman came in, and the department chairman stood up and received her like that and sat her down. Obviously the dean of whatever it was, he looked up and now, oh God, I was about to die right in front of him. It's like, the dean is here, the head of the department, oh, Swamiji. So I made the whole presentation on Sankhya, everything else, you know. And then somebody asked, he said, can you talk a little bit about your religion? And I said, well, yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have different religious perspectives, and of course I have mine. So if you want to talk afterwards, I'll be happy to talk about it. But right now we're talking about this analytical, you know, point of view like that and so on. So I was watching out of the corner of my eye, and the chairman and the dean were both up there like this, like, you know. and afterwards they'll talk to you. They'll talk to you. But that's the game. That's the rules and stuff and so on. That's so very good. So very, very nice atmosphere for talking about these things in the scientific atmosphere and communicating. And this very much touches people when they see it. You know? And at a certain point, they come, scientific perspective, and they begin to see, yeah, there has to be something more. Some people may take years to catch on. Some people, Prabhupada says most people won't even get it in this lifetime. But when they get some ideas in their heart, and they die, and they think, what was that? What did the guy say? Next time I better be more serious about this. And so they come back like, boy. So they accepted something, but it's usually not going to happen in one lifetime. You know? But other than that, some people are, and they're ready. Sukadeva Goswami became Uttamadakarya, just like that, you know, from hearing the Bhagavatam. The four Kumaras, how did they change? Four Kumaras were impersonalists. What changed them? Huh?
The smell.
Smell of what?
Lord of sweet.
Yeah, Makaman Devayu, they pay their obeisance to Vishnu, and they smell the tulsi leaves, and realize, this is not material. We're not attached to anything material. So they realize there is spiritual variety. I can go on forever. One last point. I was at the university. I started in electrical engineering. I was building superheterodyne six-stage superheterodyne AM radios with over-the-counter 12AU7 and 5U4 vacuum tubes. You're looking at somebody who used to use vacuum tubes, right? Before transistors. Yeah. 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 And they worked. So they got college, started electrical engineering. But very quickly I began to see this is just very materialistic and there's nothing more coming. And the Vietnam War and everything else was creating all this contact with Asia and philosophies and yogis. And so there's this perception in America, wow, there's something new happening. Okay, so let me change the biology. So I started studying biological engineering. I did surgery on dogs, and the dogs lived. Dogs are pretty tolerant of their bodies. If anybody knows biology, it's the same mechanistic model. They try to make it all into little chemical machines, exchange, you know. Now we know what life is. One big biology professor, he said, biology means the science of life, the science of life. But he said, but nobody kills more animals than biologists. It's the science of life, but nobody kills more people than biologists. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so what's left? So I changed the psychology. And it was still very mechanistic in many ways, but some things were the humanists and stuff had some higher things, and also some things of Jung. Carl Jung, they gave us a little bit. So by then I had to graduate. So I graduated first place in psychology, minor studies in biology, electrical engineering. Got scholarship to UCLA or Northwestern. And with Northwestern, and I could see the whole psychology career seems really also mechanistic. My mentor was president of the American Psychological Association, Donald Campbell. He said, yeah, is this for making money? If you have any masculine qualities, he said something else. Masculine qualities, you know. You'll get out of them and investigate these new areas and stuff. And you know, you won't get funding for it or anything else, and you have to be some bravery and courage. You know? So I did that. I worked a little while with the Second City. It's an improvisational theater troupe. I learned a lot. What we're doing is actually improvisational theater. It's actually Gandharva Veda. That's how we realize Krishna. Singing, dancing, and drama. So very, very good culture. Nice tradition. Then head at ease, got a black belt in Okinawan karate. I fought with a dog one time. Government entered. Fortunately, his mother called him off. So like that. I wouldn't have won. When you actually get in a fight, you don't think about anything. It's whatever conditioning you have that comes out. And I was amazed what was happening. So was he. I learned a lot about prana. About prana is new things which Western science cannot explain. You know, put with karate. And, so. And then finally came in contact with Prabhupada. I bought a Krishna book, the big one. I read it for 1 year. And I read a lot of science fiction. But here Prabhupada's describing how Jarasandha attacked Mathura, you know, 18 Akshahinis, and Krishna comes out and is chopping off heads and arms and legs, and the blood is like an ocean, and you know, the heads are like serpents or like tortoises, and yeah, all this stuff, incredible. Anybody who hears this will have this incredible benediction. You know. And so I was reading this, and the Prabhupada was a very sober person. The way he was presenting everything was very clear, incredible explanation of philosophy. And so it was strange that he was like presenting all this as just fact, you know. So at one point my mind said, this is either the biggest lie I've ever read or it's the absolute truth. Okay. Then my intelligence said to my mind, either it's the absolute truth or an absolute lie. In either case, it's absolute. I realize it's a fact. It's, what I'm looking at is totally different than anything else I've read before. And it's just like a different world. You know? So we get that direct perception of Krishna through a book or through something or through smell. And we realize this is, in the mode of goodness, we can perceive this. It's not anything to do with the senses or the mind and so on. You know? So then gradually you cultivate that. And there's a whole science, you know, the cultivation of the human spirit. You find the same science in the writings of Teresa of Avila and other people like that. Same descriptions of what's the stages and stuff. You know? Ice becomes water, becomes steam, becomes plasma. You know? Yes, it doesn't matter whether you're Christian, Muslim, yogi, or a bhakti yogi. You see, the same stages pass like that. So, but it's sophisticated science. So, koi prashna. Any questions or comments? Says, if you don't have any questions, it means you're happy in this disgusting place. So he has a question.
Thank you, Maharaj, for having me in class. My question is, how did you meet Prabhupada the first time?
No, I met him through his literature, through his books. Again, when Prabhupada came to San Francisco in 1975, and I have personally heard it from his lips. Now you can hear it from my lips. Yeah, yeah. The reporter asked him, Swamiji, what will happen to your movement when you die? Your movement when you die? And Prabhupada said, I will never die. I will live forever in my books. Yeah. You know Bhakti Bringa Maharaj, Ayodhyapati? Yeah. Maybe about like, maybe 7 years ago, he had to get his visa renewed. Okay. So in India, getting your visa renewed is a process extending over, lifetimes. first off, in Delhi, he found the office complex, and he found the building, and he found the person who's supposed to work on this. It's a true story. He went in, there was one boy working at his desk, and five more people, and some documents piled up from the time of the Viceroy in India and stuff. It was a whole building. So he looks up and he says, oh, what do you want? He says, I'm trying to renew my visa. He said, okay, well, sit down. You've got to get the P form filled out. What did you do that? Okay, you need the X form. So on. Said all this stuff. And he said, this is going to take like days to find all these places and get it done. The boy's looking at him and says, look, he locked his desk. I'll help you. So he took him around and said, you can take these stairs. Watch out for that step. It's broken. And he took him to all these people. He said, Rajiv, you got to help this guy. I'm busy. You can help him. All right. So it took about 45 minutes. They were back with all the paperwork done. And the boy's finishing the final stamping. He told him, he said, you're like the ISKCON member, disciple of Prabhupada. He said, yes. He said, that's why I'm helping you. And he opened his desk and took out Bhagavad Gita. He said, 1 year ago, I was so miserable. Who am I? What is life? What am I supposed to be doing? But I read Prabhupada's book, and now everything's so peaceful. I thought, how can I not help one of his disciples? Do you think if I wrote to Srila Prabhupada, he would answer me? 7 years ago. So I had to tell him, actually, Prabhupada left his body in 1977. It's like somebody coming in and asking, what is your name? Or some sort of news from India or whatever, your father's dead. It was that intensity. The guy just started crying and stuff, just like, shock. Other people in the office are looking, what's going on? So you can have direct... Prabhupada said, you can have direct experience of Srila Prabhupada through his books like that. So. And then other ways, what is it? Physically, I think, different dreams, some weird dreams. In San Francisco one time, Prabhupada came for the Rath Yatra, and it was the day after Rath Yatra. I wasn't initiated at all, and recovering from all this intense work and everything else. And I was sitting here, and Prabhupada was sitting there, and the temple was full. And Prabhupada and the deities were in front. And I looked up at Gornatai, the deities there, and their whole bodies were conscious like that. You see, somebody drops their wallet, and you take it, and the guy comes back looking at people. Did anybody see my wallet? You don't want to look at his eyes.
I don't know.
No, I didn't see it. So their whole bodies were like that, like just conscious and so on. One mystical experience I have with Prabhupada. But after that, some lectures. When I was initiated, there already were about maybe 1,000 disciples or something, and so on. So I didn't have some. Another time, Prabhupada needed a bell, so I was an electrical engineer. So I went to the hardware store and got a battery and the wires and hooked a bell up and had some other devotee finish it off and stuff. So Prabhupada was pushing the bell to call in servants that I made. Then in San Francisco, in Berkeley, and after the lecture was the Guru Puja. And they had some prasad and the Prabhupada would pass out for the children and everything else. So I was cooking the morning offering and the lecture was over and the devotees were still doing Guru Puja. And nobody was coming for the plate of cookies. And so I thought, oh my gosh, I had my apron on. Said, I went into the temple room. I was going to give it to somebody to give to Prabhupada. But everybody was just, you know, sort of like, honey, whoa, blah, blah, blah. And so I kept getting closer. And finally, Tamal Krishnamar pushed me. So suddenly I was in front of Prabhupada, the Yasasana, holding these cookies up with my apron on. And again, to an atheist, God appears like death. So myself, Prabhupada, was still like, kind of like, you know, Yamaraj or somebody else, holding the cookies up and they would burn me to ashes, you know, with his glance or something. It says the only physical service I ever did for Srila Prabhupada, because I was pushed, you know, by a senior godbrother. Tamal Krishnamar's key. But other than that, it's just a, you know, it's continuous experience. Prabhupada says there may be one cockroach on the king's throne, right? And the cockroach thinks, I am an intimate associate of the king. Right? No. The thing does not matter of physical proximity, but really trying to do some service. And then that, you know, that communication is there and the connection is there. So on. So if you want to serve Prabhupada, want to serve God, you know, not the devil, you know, then right away there's some connection. The world is based upon motivation. That's the primary thing. Science doesn't matter your motive. Truth for truth's sake. You know, impersonal truth. No. Your motive changes your perspective, your booty. That changes how you think about it. And even your perceptions become changed depending upon your motivation and so on. So, we kind of purify our motive. Yes,
Maharaj, you come from a scientific background, and usually in scientific study you go by a tangible proof.
Yes.
So what made you convinced about this, and how would you convince someone about soul and super soul who wants to understand it from that perspective?
Part of this is the fact that everybody's different. You know, the Kumaras, all they did, they had, you know, some scientists, they just take taste for sodomy and convince. Mm-hmm. They're ready. Yeah. What's his name? Wolfgang Pauli, you know, big Nobel laureate. He was considered the most rational of all the Nobel laureates in many ways. But another Nobel laureate wrote his biography. What's the guy's name? It was Wolfgang Pauli's Philosophical Outlook. And he said very early in his career, Pauli traced the, you know, the history of rational thought back to its roots and came to the conclusion that there were pre-rational roots to how to look at things. Euclid's Elements, the book, Euclid's Elements, it was selling the same number of copies as the Bible, you know, in the 16th century or something. And so much science is based upon Euclidean geometry. If you pull Euclidean geometry out of science, you're going to have not have a lot left. You know? Euclid defines the point, right? But these were all axioms, the postulates. Where do they come from? Why should we believe them? You have to have faith. Yes. Yeah. There's absolutely, you know, there's absolutely no reason, you know, why we accept the postulates and so on. So science is also based upon, you know, fundamental truths which cannot be proven rationally or by direct perception. You know? You cannot see points until you understand what a point is. Yeah? You got to define it and so on. Other cultures don't have points. You know, look how many points are there in this room. The room is a rectilinear structure. We think that way. Japanese culture is polar geometry. So there are many, many different kinds of people working in different ways. Cultural anthropology is also a very nice area to show people how different cultures have different experiences. You know? What's the guy's, Einstein's contemporary, David Bohm? Yeah? David Bohm, very big scientist. He said, the fact is that which is made, as in manufacture, means to make by hand. Yeah? Facts are that which is produced, right? Yeah. But we say we have tangible experience, you know, so on. My professor at Northwestern, Donald Campbell, in the 1960s, he had an experiment, and you sign up for the experiment, you come in a certain time. You come in, there's five people sitting there, and there's one chair at the end, so you sit down there. The experimenter comes in and says, look, it's very simple, there's these three lines, A, B, C. And I just want you to tell me which one is the shortest. First guy says A, B, C, A, B, C, A. Second guy says, yeah, A, goes like that. And so at the end, you'll last one, you also say A. And, every person has been tested for vision before. They have ordinary vision. Somebody's going out, then the scientist, the psychologist says to you, he says, now, the first five people were actors, right? And they may have been lying. Because social pressure, you'll say something, maybe I misunderstood or something, but you don't know anything. So is it just because of social pressure or something? Do you still think that A is the shortest line because they may have been lying? And people said, well, yeah, of course. Yeah. They say, actually, it's B. Take a look at it. And so many people at that point go, wow, you're right. Some people, they just can't accept it, right? They want a ruler. And some people try and stretch the ruler. Sitting there like, yeah. So if in that short amount of time, you know, distinguishing two linear scalars, right, can be changed like that, where's your tangible perception, fellow? Right? Well, I saw this, I saw that. Yeah. You see something else. You know, psychologists know this. You know, our perception is so dependent upon our perspective, our attitude, everything else. Well, this is bigger than that. If we just change it, this is bigger right in front of your eyes. You see it differently. Yeah? So science is not based upon, you know, an absolute, invariable thing. And as soon as you go to different cultures, you see, you know, a different perception of reality. Yeah? That's what we do. We do it through cultural anthropology. Okay? Probably says every salesman has his own technique. You got to learn from that. Different people, put it together. But in the end, you have to be able to understand yourself. And then you can explain it to other people in terms of your realization and stuff. You know? You can talk to everybody a little bit, but, you know, details? Okay, certain kind of people. One Brahmachari ashram, San Francisco has a Brahmachari. One new girl, young, very young, good-looking Western girl. She'd be very coquettish with the Brahmacharis and everything else. two or three days. And then Mother Maheshwar, this older Mataji, said, you know, I was kind of standing nearby. I heard about two sentences and went away. I would never talk to Brahmacharini like that, you know. But after that, she was like, you know. So, you know, older woman talking to younger girl, she got the message right across in language you could understand. So that's why most of the people in the Bhakti Vedanta Institute have science background. You know, Prabhupada says, never trust a skinny cook. Right? Never trust a skinny cook. Right? Yeah, it's got to be somebody. In other words, you get lots of health food and beef things. You've got to have somebody who likes to eat. So, science, so everybody, we all have our nature. We all are kind of certain people that, yeah, it's natural for us to preach to them. Yeah, definitely.
So in Eastern philosophy or in the history, they talk a bit of having infused the Western philosophy by either sending people there or having them come out. So is there something you could tell us?
From friends is Dimitri Kisikas, emeritus professor of the history of international relations from the University of Ottawa. And he was in six different who's who's and all this kind of stuff. His son actually became a devotee. He was Orthodox, Greek Orthodox Christian. He did a whole thesis on India was the center of all civilization. Okay. Maybe you could call it, and people would argue this and that, but they wouldn't say it's not like an invalid argument. But the greatest Chinese classic is Journey to the West, or some calm like that. It's about one monk, Tripitaka, who goes on the great Qing emperor sends him to go to China, to India, to get higher knowledge, like that and so on. So many things like that about China and the Orient and Khmer Rouge and Cambodia and all these places were coming to India, you know, for philosophy and these things. You know. The other side, it goes, was it Amitabha Buddha? The Amitabha Buddha, one of the Buddhas, he's considered to be Iran to be Ahura Mazda, who's the foundation of, you know, this whole Zoroastrian and tradition there, and that goes down that side, and then the Jews pick up monotheism at some point, and then it goes to Greece and it goes to Rome and it comes out like that. So he's His thesis, I mean, he defended it with good historical evidence. But the thing is, beyond 2,000 years, Western history is like, it's hard to dig things up from bones and stuff. You know? But basically, yeah, there's a lot of very, very hard evidence that India has always been the source of this philosophical attitudes and perspectives. Doesn't mean it's the only source, but still, generally speaking, in the European heaven, the British are the police, the Germans are the mechanics, the French are the lovers, the Swiss are the judges, and the Italians are the cooks. In the European hell, the British are the cooks, okay? The Germans are the police, okay? The Swiss are the lovers, yeah? The French are the mechanics, you ever had Peugeot? And the Italians are the judges, yeah? Okay. The only country in the world, in the Encyclopedia Britannica, where it talks about the philosophy of that country is India. And it's not even a part of the entry on India, it's a separate entry about the philosophy of India and so on. Maribara to Mahandra. This is what India has, and this is natural. The prophet says you only take birth in India if you were interested in spiritual life in your previous life. A couple times, so I know. So it is, this heritage, this perspective, and yeah, it's always been, as far as we can tell, that from India, ideas go to Egypt and different places. Socrates quoting ancient doctrines and Jesus. So, a lot of evidence. Yes. Yes,
ma'am. If I'm talking about myself, I have to elevate more about spiritual journey in my life.
Yeah.
Do I need to be seeker or believer or have a pivotal role of any kind of Gita in my life to just get to the, like, you know, have a parameter right there? Am I going to right or wrong? So what's your advice on that?
No, the basic principle is that we're like three-year-old children. Three-year-old kids can do interesting things, but they always, in some ways, always got to take care of them. 2 days, they'll just die if nobody takes care of them. So we're small. We're little atmas. We figure that out. So somebody's always taking care of us, Krishna. Basically, you got a choice between the two sisters, Radha and Durga. Durga's always getting you in trouble doing things, and Radha's always trying to help you. But you've got a choice. So yeah, we're always dependent. So Krishna's always trying to come and, you know, arrange experiences in life for you where you learn something and send books and this kind of stuff. So our main job is just accepting, you know, what's coming to us is good and taking advantage of it. Yeah. Yeah. So if you find some good books and stuff like that, yeah, then you should. You know. One man, there's a big rainstorm and he's, you know, the water's flooding and finally it's up to like knee level in front of his house and a big truck goes by in the road and says, this wade through the water. You know, I'll get you out of here. He says, no, I'm waiting for God to save me. Okay. Water comes higher up to the first floor, and a boat comes by and says, jump in the water, you swim over here, we'll take you out. I'm waiting for God to save me. Okay. Comes higher, he has to go on the roof, a helicopter comes and says, take the rope. He says, I'm waiting for God to save me. Okay. Goes away. Then the clouds separate, and a big light comes down on him, and a big voice says, what are you waiting for? I've already sent a truck, a boat, and a helicopter. So yeah, you should take advantage of the things that are coming, right? If you don't want to, if you want to continue with, you know, with your arrogance and everything else, okay, you know, right? In material consciousness, every man is thinking, I will become more powerful than Arnold Schwarzenegger, I will become richer than Bill Gates, I will conquer the world. Okay? But in material consciousness, every woman is thinking, that's okay. Let him conquer the world. I'll conquer him. And a very child syndrome, I will conquer the world. Material consciousness. The opposite thing is, let me get out of this mess and do something valuable for God and everybody else, you know, rather than trying to become the goddess. You know. So it's there. That's the whole point. Take the good things that come. Yeah. Okay.
I have a question about self-realization. So they say to get more spiritual, or to proceed spiritual life, you have to become more self-realized.
Yeah.
So what's the way to, I mean, they say you have to read Gita and do chanting, that
you can also read the Quran,
but does it really work in self-realization?
Yeah, well, with self-realization, just realizing what your abilities are. For example, one of my Bobby Prakash Singh, his father Chandra Prakash Singh, was, you know, Bharati Award winner. He said, "Try and write poetry." So I tried doing it. Well, I discovered, yeah, I can do that. Another person said, "Try different musical instruments." I discovered that. Someone says, "Take charge of organizing this." Well, I've never managed anything. Give it a try. You discover. You know, so self-realization means to discover your abilities. Our perspective is that we're created by God. Even God doesn't know, you know, the possibilities that we have. It's like he doesn't know his possibilities. So self-realization is an ever-increasing, you know, eternal process. You know? But at least in this world, we're trying to realize we're not matter. You know, we're not the mind. You know, Descartes, he was sitting in front of his fire one time, and he said, "I'm not the fire. I'm not the eyes that perceive this. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am." So he came to this mental level. And the Buddha said, you've got to get off that and start watching your thoughts. You know, and we're saying you have to get off that, even the other level of Buddha, and see what is your motivation. So, yeah. And you can adjust that. You can change that. It's under your free will. Yeah. And realize, you know, your higher motivations, your higher determination. Like that as well, yeah. So, for this, there's so many yogas. So many religions. They work for different people, different times, different circumstances. And as we go on, we're going to be changing it. You know, what's yoga or religion or self-realization at one point, you know, is higher later on. Yeah. So, okay. All right. Yeah. I realize I'm not the body, but I am the mind. Yeah. Oh. It's also not yourself.
I have one more question.
Okay.
It's about negative thoughts.
Yes.
How to get rid of, or how to avoid negative thoughts.
Well, the thing is, we're not opposed to negative thoughts, you know. You know, if I think negatively about killing my grandmother, it's a good idea. This is the mind. The mind uses. The mind engages in accepting or rejecting, you know, and so on. But it's, you know, destructive negative thoughts, you know. Enthusiasm is more important than patience. Patience means to stop thinking. Enthusiasm means to understand and go ahead. So yeah, enthusiasm is more important than patience. But without some patience and, you know, identifying things as negative, you become very, very sahaja, very superficial. You have to see the negative aspects of materialism along with the positive aspects of spiritual life. So to control the thoughts, and sometimes positive thoughts also aren't good. You know, so we use mantra, especially. Man means mind, tra means to take. So many tools, but mantra is always a very, very good thing. I was selling, you know, this insurance stuff one time, and they have this different things you chant. You say, like, for example, what is it? When there's this famous case, this 737 or whatever it is hit these birds, and the guy had to land in the Hudson River. You know that story? He took off, he hit these flock of ducks, and both engines went out. And he has something like, three minutes before, you know, this 40,000-ton aluminum glider had 3 minutes in the air and stuff. They made a whole movie out of what happened and so on. So, you know, he said he almost lost control of himself. He said he was this far away from, like, panicking himself. The pilot was something in his training caught him, and it's like, you know. But his mind was just already to panic like everybody else. Both engines are dead, we're like, you know. So he started going through the procedure and qualifying. Tower, we got both engines flamed out. Can you make this airport? I don't think so. What are you going to do? I'm going to land the Hudson River. Okay, Captain. They tried it with simulators later on, and nobody made it. One group made it, but just, you know, probably wouldn't be as correct. Okay. So yeah, then they're running around, and people on their cell phones, "Forgive me for our argument this morning, I love you." Everybody changed after that. Everybody came out of that thing, you know, changed. So finally, everything's set up, and they're coming down in the Hudson River, and the stewardess says, then we heard the pilot say those three words you never want to hear: brace, for impact, like that. So what do they do? The whole crew is trained. They start saying, brace, 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 brace. They could say, Christ, Christ, Christ. But that's the final death. That's their mantra, to get everybody's mind focused. So it works, you know. But what are you going to use it for? Bracing or, you know, the time of death? I want to think of something else. So mantra, you know. The Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, and of course recommending Hare Krishna. There's so many, you know, prayers in the Bible, these things are also mantras, kind of simple like that. So it's one very good technique. And using it systematically every day, chanting a certain number of times on beads, and then your mind becomes conditioned. It's like physical activity, you condition yourself to certain reflexes and stuff, and so psychological workout. When you go to work, you know, you're intelligent, submissive, critical, you're going to go up in your profession because you can hear properly and stuff and so on. So, mantra. Mantra. Yes, sir. Maybe the last question.
These days, especially youth is going through so much stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, due to the exams or studies or the job,
yeah,
career, so
yeah,
depression. So,
yeah.
What would you recommend? What would you guide us for that?
Change your job. Yeah. I mean, it's a fact, is it? When I went to graduate school, I got all this more money and everything else. My parents had gone overseas and take one last contract with the government, so I was really on my own for the first time in my life. And what is it? I was remembering, okay, I didn't have any Christian consciousness that time. It was the Bible. And I was remembering that the Bible that says that God sees when even one little bird falls down, God's conscious of this. Jesus says, so how can it be that you who are worth so much more than these birds, you know, are not also, you know, your Heavenly Father is not aware of you also? Okay, so I'm on my own, God's there. And, yeah, a few simple ideas like that. So then I took this thing of, you know, being a little brave and trying different things. And so many times I've seen people that chant and they Krishna helps them. And you get into a job or a career track, which is just is more and more to goodness. Like that. The more to passion, you're running like mad and all you're doing is just keeping up. You know? After 40 years of work, you have no money in the bank and everything else, you just survive for 40 years. Yeah? You know, you didn't fall down. The more of ignorance, you become more and more stupid, degraded, complicated, everything else. You know, you become like an animal, just stealing from your relatives to get alcohol. You know, and stuff. Really, there's all kinds of different results. But the mode of goodness, yeah, every time things are becoming more harmonious and everything else. You know. I know many, for example, one devotee, I won't mention his name, was working for Hewlett Packard. And many people experienced. So he was spending about half the time working on preaching programs for his temple and everything else and so forth. So on. And then Hewlett Packard was making big layoffs. We're going to lay off 10,000 employees or something, you know. So they said, you know, Arun, come into the office tomorrow. I want to talk to you about your last project. He was supposed to have been researching, like, marketing and stuff in Europe. He said, he didn't put it together and it wasn't all that good, he thought, like, what he could do. So he went in, he was sure he was going to get fired, you know. But not only was his boss, but it was the boss's boss there, you know. He said, Arun, we want to talk to you about your report last time. Okay, here it goes. Yeah. And he said, this is so valuable for us that we want to give you a raise so you don't go to work for somebody else. He was just really shocked, you know, so on. And he couldn't say anything. They said, he actually increased the quantity. He said, don't tell anybody else because we're laying people off of this. Okay. So he saw that, you know, Krishna will help you. Seventh canto. There's a verse, it's not even purport. There's a verse where it says, any occupation, you know, sane occupation that a grihastha takes up to make his money, to maintain himself and his family in a sensible fashion, the Supreme Lord personally cooperates to make sure it's a success. Now, not too much, not too little. It's a fair amount, sane amount. And then, you know, spiritual life, philosophical life. You know. So it's there. Try it out. You haven't got to jump. Just make those decisions. One of Dr. Jariwala was in a temple in San Jose, was an associate of Linus Pauling. He started hearing this, and he started changing his job as a chemist. And finally, he started working for a German pharmaceutical company, which only used organic sources for their vitamins, everything else. and did a lot of pro bono, free distribution of these things to people. You know? It was a very nice atmosphere. It was different than this whole thing. He knew that the other big companies were actually cheating people, and actually, you know, they didn't care about the people they were taking care of. It was how to make money off this stuff. You know, this stuff was very dangerous. So anyway, he said after he just ended up in like a decent, nice profession. You know? So many ways, you know, Krishna will help you find a job where you don't have to be in this working dog hard. So, Anutama, when they go to the United States, what he did was he would go to big corporations. They had their fleets of vehicles, vehicle, and they would sell them after maybe 3 years and so on. So they're good used cars. And he picked out, I think, one model which was very popular, and like that he knew it. He would go and bid at the auctions. He knew exactly how much to bid. Okay, he would get a few of these. He bought a house which had a big yard with big bushes around it. He had maybe four or five cars parked there. He had a mechanic he worked with. They always worked in the same cars and stuff. He would sit there and people would call up. He would sell them as a private person, you know, and made like maybe like about $800 minimum out of every single car he sold. You know? So he saw these worked out a very. And when he didn't want to do it, he'd take off, go to India. So it was very, you know, put his wife through college, had three kids. Weird case. You may have some weird karma where you're going to suffer because you did something, but you'll know, okay, this is because I did something. I deserve this. But even still, Krishna will stay with you while he's beating you. But in most cases, it's simple. You find some simple, practical way, you know, occupation. And yeah, then you make your money. Like nicely. Okay? Yeah. Other than that, morning is for spiritual life, daytime is for making money, evening is for enjoying. Yeah. So get up early, do your spiritual practices, don't touch your email, and the time of day comes, you're fixed. You know why you're doing it, and what Krishna's there, and you go out and make money. That's why I'm here, to make money. But for Krishna, to help people. Yeah. Evening time, okay, take a bath, have prasad. Go with your family to the mall, look for things for your deities, and high devotees over, and then watch the latest Mahabharata movie. that's it. Okay, so divide your day up, you know. Morning is my spiritual life, daytime is for making money, and the evening is for enjoying. Okay. One more question.
You just mentioned about the Hudson River landing.
Yeah.
So when his engines flamed out, he had two chances where he could have either landed at LaGuardia or Teterboro.
He had
LaGuardia or Teterboro, and he decided to land on the Hudson River.
They did that with simulators afterwards. He tried sitting with six people in simulators. Only one of them made it.
Yeah.
And that was like, he wouldn't have had the time the guy had to make the decision and call him.
Yeah. But he ended up saving lives of each soul on the plane.
Everybody.
So how can we distinguish if it was an intelligence that was manifested by the super soul, or was this his mental speculation?
Prabhupada says, a lot of my physical association with Prabhupada was to Hansa Duda, Bhakti Srupa Dhamana Maharaj and Jayananda. And I knew them, so I could adjust what they were saying. You know? So Hansa Duda told us, the Prabhupada said, that the spiritual master trains a disciple to recognize the promptings of the super soul as distinct from the senses, as distinct from the mind, you know, so that he can be guided when the spiritual master is not present. The same way a mother trains her child to recognize when he has to urinate. Yeah. You identify, oh, that's the sensation and stuff, and then they can tell, I have to go use the bathroom. Yeah. So it's there. We can distinguish this. You know. You can understand what are our senses. By chanting Hare Krishna, following the process, you can get free from the point where you can see like your tobacco addiction, chanting and stuff, and you watch it and figure out what's going on. Okay, that's my senses, it's not me. Same way, mantra, you can come to the point where you start to look at your mind and so on. And finally, buddhi, and then you can actually, you know, go beyond the attitude perspective. It's a whole development. And very practical. And different people develop it in different ways and so on in terms of their present circumstances. But at that point then we see this is not coming from my mind, this is not coming from my intelligence, this is coming from Krishna. Yeah. I was coming to temple, chanting everything else, visiting, trying to understand the philosophy. after Sunday feast, they had kirtan, the brahmacharis were chanting, I bought a set of kartals, and I was playing them, played them in chanting. And I realized my senses were fully engaged, my mind was fully engaged, and I could tell it, it's not me, the yoga was doing it. And I was looking at Radha Gokul and Ananda, and I realized that, you know, they were not a product of my mind and senses. And I was, my automatic thing was, you know, I want to come back to you. Yeah, take the rope. Chant 16 rounds, follow four principles. So that's diksha. By the process, you get in the mode of goodness, and you see Krishna, really. Not what you're going to get out for get from him, out of fear, but you actually see, Ram says, the Vibhishan, right? The Vibhishan comes to surrender, and everybody says, don't trust him, this and that. And Ram, very famous verse, it's in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Eva Sakya Prapaipana. If somebody in sincerity, mode of goodness, mercy of association of guru, says, I am yours, you know, please help me return to you. From that point, I give him all intelligence how to come to me. This is my eternal vow. So that's diksha, that point of connecting up. And at that point, you know, in intense moments we can tell when you fall back down to our ordinary life. We're chanting, we're kirtan. Yeah, but we know, I remember, yeah, I can get in that state of consciousness. But it becomes more and more common, right? So finally, by second initiation, we're brahmanas. We're always with the absolute truth, at least in a general sense. Like that. The next Paramatma, the son Goswami, then we can see all the folk, see Krishna's hand and things. And finally, Uttamadhikara, you're actually just playing with Krishna or arguing with Krishna. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a gradual process. It usually doesn't happen until about second initiation where you can really trust your inspiration. Before that, you really should confirm. I want to blow up the Twin Towers, okay? Yeah. And you go to your guru and you say, well, that's not a good idea. It's the devil talking. Yeah. So by second initiation, Prabhupada said, by that time, yeah, you should be purified enough where you can begin to distinguish. And third initiation, yeah, it's very precise. Yeah. So I want to thank everybody. Hare Krishna. Tomorrow night we'll go ahead and start with this Carl Jung, the psychologist, like that. So if anybody has trouble with their mind, can come tomorrow night. Everybody has trouble with their mind. So Paul Flaherty, God. Hare Krishna.